The Time Traveler. Chapter 1. The Time Traveler was explaining a difficult idea to us. His pale gray eyes were bright and alert, and his face, usually calm and colorless, was flushed with energy. The fire burned strongly, and the soft glow from the electric lights reflected off the silver lilies on the table, catching the bubbles as they rose and vanished in our glasses. The chairs we sat in were his own design. Instead of resisting the body, they seemed to shape themselves around it, holding you comfortably rather than merely supporting you. The room had that easy, unhurried feeling that comes after dinner, when no one is in a hurry and thought moves freely without the need for strict accuracy. As he spoke, he made his points carefully, tapping the air with a long, thin finger. We listened while sitting back, relaxed, watching his intensity with quiet interest. To us, it seemed like another clever idea, a paradox to be admired rather than believed.
"You'll need to pay close attention," he said. "I'm going to challenge one or two ideas that almost everyone accepts without question. Geometry, for example. What you were taught at school is built on a mistake."
"That's a large claim to start with," said Philby. He was argumentative by nature and had red hair.
"I'm not asking you to accept anything without reason," the time traveler replied. "You'll see soon enough that I only need you to agree to a few simple points. You know, of course, that a mathematical line has no thickness. A line of zero width has no physical existence. You were taught that. The same is true of a mathematical plane. These are abstractions, not real things."
"That's fair enough," said the psychologist.
"Then consider this," the time traveler went on. "If something has only length, breadth, and thickness, it still cannot truly exist."
"There I disagree," said Philby. "Solid objects exist, all real things."
"So people assume," the time traveler said. "But let me ask you something. Can an instantaneous cube exist?"
"I don't follow," said Philby. "Can a cube that exists for no time at all truly exist?"
Philby stopped speaking and thought. "Any real object," the time traveler continued, "must extend in four directions: length, breadth, thickness, and duration. Time. We overlook this because of a weakness in our perception, which I'll explain shortly. There are four dimensions. Three are what we call space. The fourth is time." He paused briefly, then went on. "We make an artificial distinction between time and the three dimensions of space, because our awareness moves in only one direction a long time. From the beginning of our lives to the end."
"That," said a very young man who was struggling to relight his cigar over the lamp, "is very clear."
"It's remarkable how often this is overlooked," the time traveler said, sounding slightly more pleased. "This is what people mean when they talk about the fourth dimension, though many of them don't realize it. It's simply another way of describing time. There is no real difference between time and the dimensions of space, except that our consciousness moves along it."
He looked around the room.
"Some people misunderstand this idea completely. You've all heard what they say about the fourth dimension."
"I haven't," said the provincial mayor. "They say this," the time traveler replied. "Space, as mathematics describes it, has three dimensions: length, breadth, and thickness. These are defined by three planes at right angles to one another. Some thinkers ask why there should be exactly three. Why not another direction at right angles to all the others?" He held up a finger. "They've even tried to imagine a geometry of four dimensions. Professor Simon Newcomb spoke on this subject recently in New York. You know how we can represent a three-dimensional object on a flat surface, which itself has only two dimensions. In the same way, they believe a three-dimensional model could represent a four-dimensional form if we could learn how to see it properly."
"I think I understand,"
said the provincial mayor. He frowned, lips moving slightly as if repeating the idea to himself. After a moment, his face brightened briefly.
Yes, I think I see.
I don't mind telling you, the time traveler said, that I've been working on this four-dimensional geometry for some time. Some of the results are curious. Imagine a man at 8 years old, then at 15, then at 17, then at 23. Each image is a section, a three-dimensional slice of a four-dimensional being, which itself does not change. He waited while we absorbed this.
Scientists already know this, whether they admit it or not, he went on. Time is a kind of space. Here's a simple example, a weather chart.
He traced a line in the air with his finger. This line shows the movement of the barometer. Yesterday it was high. Last night it fell. This morning it rose again. The mercury did not move through space in the ordinary sense, but it traced a line. That line exists in time. The medical man stared into the fire.
If time really is a fourth dimension of space, he said, why is it treated as something separate? And why can't we move through it the way we move through space?
The time traveler smiled.
Are you sure we move freely through space? He asked. We can move forward and sideways easily enough. People always have. But what about up and down? Gravity limits us.
There are balloons, said the medical man. Before balloons, the time traveler replied, people had almost no freedom of vertical movement, except jumping or walking on uneven ground.
Still, said the medical man, they could move a little. Much easier to go down than up, said the time traveler. And you can't move at all through time, said the medical man. You can't escape the present moment.
My dear sir, said the time traveler, that is where you're mistaken. That is where everyone is mistaken. We are always leaving the present moment. Our minds move along the time dimension at a steady rate, from birth to death. Just as we would fall steadily if we began life high above the earth. But the real difficulty, said the psychologist, interrupting him, is this. You can move freely in all directions of space, but you cannot move freely in time.
That, said the time traveler, is the starting point of my discovery. And even there, you're not quite right when you say we cannot move in time.
He shifted slightly in his chair. When you remember something very clearly, you return to the moment it happened. You become absent-minded, as people say. For an instant, you move backward along the time dimension. He paused, letting that sink in.
Of course we cannot remain there. Any more than an animal can remain 6 feet above the ground. But a civilized person has an advantage over an animal. We have balloons. We can rise against gravity. And there's no reason to believe we won't one day learn to control our movement through time as well.
Oh, this is all, Philby began.
Why not? The time traveler said calmly. It's against reason, said Philby.
Whose reason? Asked the time traveler.
You can prove anything with arguments, said Philby, but you won't convince me.
Perhaps not, said the time traveler. But now you begin to see the point of my work in four-dimensional geometry. Long ago, I began to suspect the possibility of a machine.
A machine to travel through time, cried the very young man.
Yes, said the time traveler. A machine that could move through space and time in any direction the operator chose. Philby laughed. But I have experimental proof, said the time traveler.
That would be useful for historians, said the psychologist. One could go back and verify accepted accounts. The Battle of Hastings, for example. You would draw attention, said the medical man. People in the past were not kind to things that didn't belong.
One could learn Greek directly from Homer or Plato, said the very young man.
In that case,
someone said. They'd certainly fail you. Scholars have improved Greek since then.
And there's the future, said the very young man. Imagine investing money and going ahead to collect it.
To discover a society, I said, built on strict communism.
Of all the wild ideas, began the psychologist.
Yes, said the time traveler. That's how it seemed to me as well, which is why I said nothing about it until...
Experimental proof, I said. You intend to test it?
The experiment, said Philby, sounding tired.
Let's see it, said the psychologist. Even if it's nonsense.
The time traveler looked around the room. He smiled faintly. Then, with his hands in his pockets, he walked slowly out. We heard his slippers along the long corridor, fading toward the laboratory. The psychologist looked at the rest of us.
I wonder what he has.
Some trick, said the medical man.
Philby began to tell a story about a magician he had once seen, but before he could finish, the time traveler returned. He carried a small metallic framework in his hand. It glittered in the firelight. It was no larger than a clock, and very finely made. Parts of it were ivory. Other parts were made of some clear, crystalline material. I must be exact here. What follows is impossible to explain unless his account is accepted. He took one of the small octagonal tables scattered around the room and placed it in front of the fire, with two of its legs on the hearthrug. On this table, he set the model. Then he pulled up a chair and sat down. The only other object on the table was a small lamp with a shade, positioned so that its bright light fell directly on the machine. Around the room were perhaps a dozen candles. Two stood in brass holders on the mantel. Others were set in wall sconces. The room was brightly lit. I sat in a low armchair nearest the fire and moved it forward so that I was almost between the time traveler and the fireplace. Philby sat behind him, looking over his shoulder. The medical man and the provincial mayor watched from the right, in profile. The psychologist watched from the left. The very young man stood behind the psychologist. We were all paying close attention. It seems impossible to me now that any trick, no matter how cleverly done, could have been carried out under these conditions. The time traveler looked from us to the machine.
Well, said the psychologist.
This, said the time traveler, resting his elbows on the table and pressing his hands together above the model, is only a model. It represents my plan for a time machine. He pointed to it. You'll notice it's uneven in shape, and this bar here has a strange appearance, as though it were not entirely real. Here are two small white levers. The medical man stood and bent over the table. It's beautifully made, he said.
It took 2 years, said the time traveler.
When we had all leaned in to look, he continued. This lever sends the machine forward through time. This one reverses it. This small saddle represents the seat of the time traveler. He paused. In a moment, I will press the lever. The machine will move. It will vanish. It will pass into time. He looked at each of us. Examine it carefully. Examine the table. I don't want to destroy this model and then be told I'm a fraud. There was a brief pause. The psychologist looked as though he might speak to me, then decided against it. The time traveler reached toward the lever.
No,
he said suddenly. Give me your hand. He turned to the psychologist, took his hand in his own, and guided his forefinger toward the lever.
You press it.
So it was the psychologist himself who set the model time machine in motion. We all saw the lever move. I am absolutely certain there was no trick. There was a sudden breath of air. The flame of the lamp flickered. One of the candles on the mantle was blown out. The little machine spun slightly, grew indistinct, and for a moment looked like a faint ghost of itself.
It appeared as a swirl of pale brass and ivory. Then it was gone. It had vanished. The table was bare except for the lamp. No one spoke. After a moment, Philby said he was damned. The psychologist recovered first. He bent down and looked under the table. At that, the time traveler laughed softly.
"Well?" he said.
He stood up, walked to the mantel, and began filling his pipe with his back to us. We looked at one another.
"Are you serious?" said the medical man. "Do you truly believe that machine has traveled through time?"
"Yes," said the time traveler. He bent to light a spill at the fire. Then, pipe lit, he turned to watch the psychologist's face. The psychologist, to show he was not unsettled, took a cigar and attempted to light it without cutting it.
"What's more," said the time traveler, "I have a full-sized machine nearly finished in the laboratory."
He nodded toward the door.
"When it's complete, I intend to travel in it myself." "You mean to say that machine went into the future?" said Philby.
"Into the future," said the time traveler, "or into the past. I can't say which with certainty." There was a pause. Then the psychologist spoke.
"If it went anywhere," he said, "it must have gone into the past."
"Why?" asked the time traveler.
"Because it hasn't moved in space," said the psychologist. "If it had gone into the future, it would still be here now. It would have passed through this moment."
"But if it went into the past," I said, "we should have seen it before. Last Thursday, and the Thursday before that, and so on."
"Serious objections," said the provincial mayor, turning toward the time traveler with a neutral expression.
"Not at all," said the time traveler. He looked at the psychologist. "You can explain it."
The psychologist nodded. "That's a simple matter of perception," he said. "Presentation below the threshold. Diluted perception."
He turned to us. "We don't see it for the same reason we don't see a spinning wheel spoke or a bullet in flight. If it's moving through time much faster than we are, it doesn't remain long enough in any moment to register clearly." He passed his hand through the empty space above the table. "If it moves through a minute of time while we move through a second, the impression it creates is only a fraction of what it would otherwise be."
He laughed lightly. "You see?"
We sat and stared at the empty table for a short while. Then the time traveler asked what we thought.
"It sounds reasonable tonight," said the medical man.
"But wait until morning. Let's see what common sense says then."
"Would you like to see the machine itself?" said the time traveler.
He took up the lamp and led the way down the long, drafty corridor to the laboratory. I remember the flickering light, his broad head in silhouette, the moving shadows on the walls. We followed him, uncertain and skeptical. In the laboratory, we saw a larger version of the model we had just watched disappear. Parts of it were nickel, parts were ivory. Some components were clearly cut from crystal. The machine was mostly complete, but twisted crystal bars lay unfinished on the bench beside sheets of drawings. I picked one up to examine it more closely. It appeared to be quartz.
"Are you serious?" said the medical man. "Or is this another trick, like that ghost you showed us last Christmas?"
"On that machine," said the time traveler, raising the lamp. "I intend to explore time." He looked at us steadily.
"I have never been more serious in my life."
None of us knew how to respond. I caught Philby's eye over the medical man's shoulder. He winked at me solemnly. Chapter 2. I don't think any of us truly believed in the time machine at that point. The trouble was the time traveler himself. He was one of those men who are almost too sharp to trust. You never felt you'd seen his whole mind. Even when he sounded open, you had the sense there was a clever reserve behind it, something held back, something ready to appear at the right moment. His honesty felt polished.
and because of that, we suspected a trick. If Philby had shown the model and explained it in the time traveler's own words, we might have doubted Philby less. We would have understood Philby's motives. A plain man can read another plain man. But the time traveler had a streak of whim in him, and that made us cautious. With him, the same thing that would have made another man famous looked like a performance. It's a mistake to do things too easily. People begin to think the ease is the trick. The serious men among us, the ones who wanted to treat the matter seriously, never felt completely safe doing it. They sensed that staking their reputations for judgment on the time traveler was like filling a nursery with delicate china. So between that Thursday and the next, I don't think any of us spoke much about time traveling. Still, the thought kept running in the background. The odd possibilities. The logic that almost worked. The practical impossibility that sat beside it. The mess of cause and effect it hinted at. The confusion it suggested. For my part, I couldn't stop thinking about the model. That little vanishing act stayed with me. I remember discussing it with the medical man when I met him on Friday at the Linnaean. He told me he'd seen something similar once in Germany, and said the candle going out mattered, but he couldn't tell me how the thing was done. The next Thursday, I went again to Richmond. I was one of his most regular guests. I arrived late and found 4 or 5 men already gathered in his drawing room. The medical man stood by the fire with a sheet of paper in one hand and his watch in the other. I looked around for our host.
"It's 7:30 now," the medical man said. "I suppose we'd better start dinner."
"Where is he?" I asked.
"You've just arrived?" the doctor said.
"It's odd. He's unavoidably detained. He sent this note. He says we should begin at 7 if he isn't back, and that he'll explain when he comes."
"It would be a shame to let dinner spoil," said the editor of a well-known daily paper.
The doctor rang the bell. Besides the doctor and myself, only the psychologist had been at the previous dinner. The others were blank, the editor, a journalist, and another man I didn't know. He was quiet and shy, with a beard. I don't think he opened his mouth all evening. I've always thought of him as the silent man. At the table, there was a good deal of wondering about the time traveler's absence. "Half as a joke," I suggested time traveling. The editor turned to me. "Time traveling? Explain that." The psychologist volunteered an account. It was accurate enough, but he delivered it the way a man describes something he doesn't quite believe in himself. He called it an ingenious paradox and a clever trick. He was in the middle of it when the door to the corridor opened slowly, without a sound. I was facing the door and saw it first.
"Well," I said, "at last."
The door opened wider and the time traveler stood there. I made a noise I couldn't help. The medical man saw him next.
"Good heavens," he said. "Man, what's happened to you?"
Everyone turned. He looked as if he'd walked in from a road accident. His coat was dusty and filthy, with smears of green down the sleeves. His hair was disordered, and it looked grayer than I remembered, whether from dust or from something else I couldn't say. His face was very pale. There was a cut on his chin, half healed. His expression was drawn and exhausted, as though he had been in pain for days. For a moment, he hesitated in the doorway, blinking as if the light hurt him. Then he came into the room. He walked with a limp, the kind you see in men whose feet are ruined from long walking. We stared at him in silence, waiting. He didn't speak. He moved to the table and reached toward the wine. The editor filled a champagne glass and pushed it to him. He drank it in one pull. It seemed to steady him. The faintest trace of his old smile flickered across his face.
"What on earth have you been doing?"
the doctor asked. The time traveler didn't seem to hear.
Please don't stop on my account, he said with a slight stumble over the words. I'm all right.
He held out his glass again, drank another, and nodded as if he were testing the effect.
That's good, he said.
His eyes sharpened. A little color returned to his cheeks. He looked from face to face with a slow, dull approval, then around the comfort of the room as if checking that it was real.
I'm going to wash and dress, he said. Then I'll come down and explain. Save me some of that mutton. I'm starving for meat.
He looked across at the editor, who wasn't often there, and made a small, polite remark about seeing him. The editor started a question.
Tell you presently, the time traveler said. I'm not myself yet. I'll be all right in a minute.
He set his glass down and walked toward the stairs. That limp was clearer now. And as he went out, I saw his feet.
He had nothing on them but torn socks, stained with blood.
The door closed behind him. For a moment, I considered following, then stopped myself. He hated fuss. He hated being surrounded. My mind drifted, blank for a second, trying to catch up to what I'd seen. Then the editor spoke, almost to himself, like a man writing headlines.
Remarkable behavior of an eminent scientist.
The journalist laughed.
What's the game? He said. Is he playing at being a tramp? I don't follow.
I caught the psychologist's eye. His look matched mine. I thought again of that limp, the blood-stained socks, the way he'd drunk the champagne like medicine. I don't think the others had noticed his feet. The medical man recovered first. He rang for a hot plate because the time traveler disliked servants waiting at table. The editor grunted and returned to his knife and fork. The silent man did the same, awkwardly. Dinner resumed. Conversation came back in short bursts, broken by pauses of unease. The surprise still sat heavily on us. Then the editor's curiosity got the better of him.
What do you make of it? He said. Is this about that machine of his?
I'm sure it is, I replied, and I went over again, as carefully as I could, what the psychologist had shown us the week before. The new guests listened with open disbelief. The editor raised objections at once.
What exactly is this time traveling? He said. You don't pick up dust by rolling around in a paradox.
As the idea amused him more and more, he drifted into caricature. He wondered aloud whether the future had no clothes brushes. The journalist joined in eagerly. Both of them were of the new school, light-hearted, irreverent, quick to laugh. They found it easy to make sport of the whole thing.
Our special correspondent in the Day After Tomorrow reports, the journalist began, raising his voice.
He was cut off by the door opening again. The time traveler had returned. He was now dressed in ordinary evening clothes. Nothing remained of his earlier appearance except the haggard look about his face. He paused for a moment, then took his place at the table without comment.
The editor burst into laughter. So these gentlemen say you've been traveling into the middle of next week, he said. Tell us all about it. What will you take for the story?
The time traveler smiled faintly, in his old way. Where's my mutton? He said. It's a fine thing to put a fork into meat again.
Story, cried the editor.
Story be hanged, the time traveler said. I want food. I won't say a word until I've got something into my system.
Thanks. And the salt. I leaned forward.
One question, I said. Have you been time traveling?
Yes, he said with his mouth full, nodding once. The editor laughed softly.
I'd give a shilling a line for that, he said.
The time traveler pushed his glass toward the silent man and tapped it with his fingernail. The silent man, who had been staring fixedly at his face, started and poured him more wine. The rest of the dinner was uncomfortable. Questions kept rising to my lips and stopping there. I could see the same thing happening with the others. The journalist tried to ease the tension by telling a string of anecdotes. No one paid much attention. The time traveler ate with the appetite of a man who has gone without food far too long. The medical man smoked and watched him closely, his eyes half closed. The silent man drank champagne steadily, with a kind of nervous determination. At last, the time traveler pushed his plate away.
"I suppose I should apologize," he said. "I was simply starving. I've had a most extraordinary experience."
He reached for a cigar and clipped the end.
"But not here," he went on. "This isn't a story for greasy plates. Let's go into the smoking room."
He rang the bell as he rose and led the way into the next room. As he settled into his chair, he turned to me.
"You told Blank and Dash and Cho's about the machine?" he asked, naming the three new men.
"I did," I said.
"But it's nothing more than a paradox," the editor broke in.
"I'm not going to argue tonight," the time traveler said. "I'm too tired for that. I don't mind telling you what happened, but I can't argue. Not now."
He paused, then looked at each of us in turn.
"I'll tell you the story," he said. "You won't believe it. Most of it will sound like nonsense. That can't be helped. It's true all the same. Every word of it."
He leaned back, gathering himself. "I was in my laboratory at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Since then, I've lived 8 days. Days like no one has lived before. I'm worn out. But I won't sleep until I've told you what happened. Then I'll go to bed."
He lifted a hand slightly.
"But no interruptions. I want to tell it straight through. Is that agreed?"
"Agreed," said the editor.
The rest of us echoed him.
He began to speak.
At first, he talked like a man close to exhaustion. His voice was steady but subdued. As he went on, it gathered strength. Most of us sat in shadow. The candles in the smoking room had not been lit. Only the journalist's face and the silent man's legs, from the knees down, caught the light of the lamp. At first, we glanced at one another. After a while, we stopped doing even that. Our eyes stayed on the time traveler.
"I told some of you last Thursday," he said, "about the principles of the time machine. I showed you the thing itself, unfinished, in my workshop. It's here now. Travel worn, you might say. One ivory bar is cracked. A brass rail is bent. But it still works. I expected to finish it on Friday. When I was nearly done, I discovered that one of the nickel bars was an inch too short. I had to have it remade. Because of that, the machine wasn't complete until this morning."
"It was 10 o'clock today when the first time machine began its career." He stopped for a second, then continued.
"I went over every screw again. I put one last drop of oil on the quartz rod. Then I sat in the saddle. I suppose a man about to pull a trigger feels much the same curiosity about what comes next. I took the starting lever in one hand and the stopping lever in the other. I pressed the first, and almost at once the second. I felt as if I were falling. I looked around. The laboratory looked exactly the same. For a moment, I thought nothing had happened. Then I noticed the clock. A moment before, it had been just past 10. Now it was nearly 3:30. He drew a breath. I set my teeth, gripped the starting lever with both hands, and pushed it forward. The room seemed to tighten around him as he spoke. The laboratory blurred and darkened. Mrs. Watchett came in and crossed the room. She didn't see me. She seemed to rush across the space like a shadow. I pushed the lever farther. Night fell as suddenly as a lamp going out. Then came day. Then night again. Faster and faster. The room faded away. A low humming filled my ears. My thoughts grew dull and confused. I can't properly describe the sensation, he went on. It was extremely unpleasant. There was the same helpless feeling you get on a runaway ride.
a headlong motion, and with it, the constant expectation of a crash. As I increased speed, night followed day like the beating of dark wings. The laboratory faded and fell away. I saw the sun leap across the sky, jumping from place to place. Each leap marked a day. For a time, I thought the house must have vanished and that I had come out into the open air. I caught a vague glimpse of scaffolding, but I was already moving too fast to make sense of anything. Even the slowest thing you can imagine would have flashed past me. The alternation of light and darkness hurt my eyes. In the brief darkness, I saw the moon spinning rapidly through its phases. I caught faint glimpses of the stars. As I went faster still, night and day blended into a steady gray. The sky deepened into a rich blue, like an endless twilight. The sun stretched into a burning arc. The moon became a pale band. The stars vanished except for rare flickers. The landscape below me was vague and shifting. I was still on the hillside, where this house stands now. The slope rose beside me, gray and indistinct. Trees appeared and changed like drifting smoke. They grew, spread, shuddered, and vanished. Great buildings rose and fell like dreams. The whole surface of the earth seemed to melt and flow. The little hands on the dials that measured my speed raced faster and faster. After a time, I noticed that the sun's path was swaying up and down. Seasons were passing in moments. I was traveling more than a year each minute. Snow flashed across the land and disappeared. Spring followed it, brief and bright. The worst of the unpleasant sensations faded then. What remained turned into something like wild excitement. I noticed that the machine was swaying clumsily, though I couldn't account for it. My mind was too confused to focus on that. With a kind of reckless resolve, I pushed myself forward into the future. At first, I hardly thought at all. Then curiosity returned, and with it, fear. What would humanity become? What strange developments might appear when I finally stopped? What advances might have been made upon our rough civilization? I saw vast buildings rising around me. They were larger than anything of our time. They seemed solid, yet unreal, as if built from mist. The hillside turned a deep, lasting green. There was no sign of winter. Even through my confusion, the earth looked fair. Then my thoughts turned to stopping. That was where the danger lay. While I traveled quickly, I passed through matter like vapor. To stop meant forcing myself, particle by particle, into whatever lay in my path. It meant bringing my body into contact with another substance so closely that a violent reaction might occur, possibly an explosion that would destroy both the machine and myself. I had thought about this risk many times while building the machine. Then it had seemed like one of the risks a man accepts when he chooses to do something new. Now that the risk was unavoidable, I did not view it so calmly. The strangeness of everything, the constant swaying, and above all the feeling of prolonged falling had shaken my nerves. I told myself I could never stop. And then, in a moment of impatience, I decided to stop at once. I pulled the lever over. The machine lurched. I was thrown forward. There was a sound like thunder. I may have been stunned for a moment. When I became aware again, hail was falling around me. I was sitting on soft turf beside the overturned machine. Everything looked gray. The hailstones rebounded and danced around me like smoke. In a moment, I was soaked through. "A fine welcome," I said aloud, "to a man who has traveled so far to see you." Then I noticed a large shape beyond the bushes. A tall white figure, barely visible through the downpour. I stood and watched as the hail thinned. The figure grew clearer. It was enormous. A silver birch reached its shoulder. It was carved from white stone, shaped like a winged sphinx. Its wings spread wide as if it were hovering. The pedestal beneath it was bronze, thick with green corrosion. The face was turned toward me. The eyes were blank, but they seemed to watch. There was a faint suggestion of a smile on the lips. The stone was worn by time in a way that suggested decay. I stood looking at it for a long while. I can't say how long. The hail thinned further. The sky began to brighten. And then the full danger of my journey struck me. He paused, then went on more slowly. What would appear when the storm cleared? He said. What might humanity have become? What if cruelty had grown stronger? What if the race had changed into something cold, unsympathetic, and powerful? I might seem like some ancient animal, fit only to be destroyed. Even as I thought this, more shapes appeared through the thinning hail, vast buildings with tall columns and intricate walls. A wooded hillside crept into view as the storm faded. Fear took hold of me. I turned back to the time machine and tried to set it upright. As I struggled with it, sunlight broke through the clouds. The hail vanished. The storm swept away as if it had never been. The sky above was a deep summer blue. The buildings around me stood clear and bright, their surfaces shining with rain and dotted with unmelted hail. I felt exposed, naked, in a strange world. I felt as a bird might feel, he went on, suddenly alone in open air, knowing danger could come from anywhere. Panic rose quickly. I took a moment to breathe, set my teeth, and forced the machine upright. It struck my chin as it turned, and I stood there panting, one hand on the saddle, the other on the lever, ready to mount it again. But the moment I knew I could retreat, my courage returned. I began to look at the world more carefully and with less fear. In a round opening high in the wall of a nearby building, I saw figures. They were dressed in soft, flowing clothes. They had seen me, and their faces were turned toward me. Then I heard voices coming closer. Through the bushes near the white sphinx, I saw heads and shoulders moving. People were running. One of them stepped out onto the path that led to the lawn. He was small, no more than 4 feet tall. He wore a purple tunic tied with a belt. His legs were bare to the knees. His feet were covered with light sandals. His head was uncovered. For the first time, I noticed how warm the air was. He struck me as graceful and beautiful, but extremely fragile. His flushed face reminded me of people weakened by long illness, yet still delicate and pleasant to look at. At the sight of him, my fear eased. I took my hands away from the machine. He came closer, smiling, and spoke in a soft, musical voice. I couldn't understand the words, but the tone was friendly. Others followed him. They were similar in size and appearance. They gathered around me, watching with open curiosity. None of them showed fear. I tried to speak to them. They listened, but didn't understand. One touched my coat. Another laughed quietly. They led me away from the machine. I hesitated, but I went with them. I glanced back once. The white sphinx stood behind us, silent and unmoving. They brought me into one of the great buildings. Inside, it was cool and spacious. The walls were smooth. The light was soft and even. They gave me fruit to eat. It was strange, but pleasant. I was very hungry and ate quickly. They watched me as I ate. Their expressions were gentle, childlike. I tried to ask questions. They answered me with smiles and soft sounds. but we shared no language. As I rested, my thoughts returned again to the time machine. It was still on the lawn, exposed. I wanted to go back to it. I stood and tried to leave. They didn't stop me, but they clearly didn't understand why I wished to go. When I reached the lawn, my heart sank. The time machine was gone. The place where it had stood was empty. Only the disturbed grass remained. For a moment, I couldn't move. I felt cold, though the air was warm. They watched me, puzzled by my distress. I searched the area wildly. I ran my hands across the ground. I walked in circles, hoping I had somehow missed it. The machine was gone. With it went my sense of control. I had come here believing myself master of time. Now I was stranded. I felt helpless, alone. The future, which moments earlier had seemed calm, now felt uncertain and dangerous. I turned back toward the White Sphinx. It stood unchanged. Its stone face was blank. The bronze base caught the light. A sudden thought came to me. The machine might be hidden inside it. I examined the pedestal closely. There was a panel. It was shut. My fear hardened into anger. I struck the bronze. The sound rang hollow. The little people watched, confused by my agitation. I tried to force the panel open. It wouldn't move. And then I understood something terrible. I was at their mercy, and they did not even know it. "That," he said quietly, "was when I first felt truly lost." He stopped speaking. The room around us was completely still. No one moved. No one spoke. The lamp burned steadily on the table between us. After a moment, he leaned back in his chair. That was where his account ended for the night. Chapter 3. A City of Ruins. In another moment, we were standing face to face. I stood there, and so did this small, fragile being from the far future. He walked straight up to me and laughed openly into my face. What struck me at once was the complete absence of fear. He showed none at all. Then he turned to the two others who had followed him and spoke to them in a language unlike anything I had ever heard. It was soft, flowing, and musical. More of them appeared. Soon there were 8 or 10 gathered around me. One spoke directly to me. It occurred to me, strangely enough, that my own voice would sound harsh and heavy to them. I shook my head and pointed to my ears to show I did not understand. He stepped closer, hesitated, then reached out and touched my hand. Others followed his example. I felt light fingers on my back and shoulders. They were gentle, almost careful. They seemed to want to make sure I was solid, real. There was nothing threatening in this. On the contrary, something about these people invited trust. They had a graceful gentleness, an easy, childlike manner. They also looked so small and frail that I felt certain I could have scattered them without effort if I wished. Still, when I saw their pink fingers touching the time machine, I made a quick motion to stop them. That was when I remembered a danger I had overlooked. Leaning over the frame of the machine, I unscrewed the small levers that controlled its movement and put them into my pocket. Only then did I turn back and try again to communicate. Looking more closely at their faces, I began to notice details I had missed at first. Their beauty was delicate and precise, like fine porcelain. Their hair was curly and stopped sharply at the neck and cheeks. There was no hair at all on their faces. Their ears were very small. Their mouths were small too, with bright red lips that were thin rather than full. Their chins came to a slight point. Their eyes were large and calm. and though this may sound self-centered, I felt there was something missing. A lack of curiosity. They looked at me with pleasure, not interest. They did not try to speak to me in any serious way. They simply stood nearby, smiling and murmuring softly to one another. Since they made no attempt to question me, I decided to begin. I pointed to myself, then to the time machine. Then, after a pause, I pointed toward the sun, trying to express the idea of time. One of them, dressed in a checked purple and white garment, followed my gesture. Then, to my surprise, he imitated the sound of thunder. For a moment, I was taken aback, though his meaning was clear enough. The thought struck me sharply. Were these people foolish? I had always assumed that the people of this distant age would be far beyond us in knowledge and understanding. And here was one of them asking, in effect, whether I had come from the sun in a storm. It forced a judgment I had been holding back. Their light limbs, their soft clothes, their fragile appearance. A wave of disappointment passed through me. For an instant, I felt as if the time machine itself had been a mistake. I nodded. I pointed again at the sun. Then I made as convincing a thunderclap as I could. The sound startled them. They stepped back and bowed slightly. Then one of them came forward laughing, holding a chain of flowers unlike any I had ever seen, and placed it around my neck. The others responded with soft applause. Soon they were running back and forth, bringing more flowers, laughing as they threw them over me until I was nearly buried in blossoms. It is difficult to describe how delicate and beautiful those flowers were. Generations of careful growth had shaped them into forms beyond anything familiar to me. Someone then suggested that their curiosity should be satisfied inside one of the nearby buildings. They led me away, past the white stone sphinx, which seemed to watch us with the same faint smile, and toward a vast gray structure made of patterned stone. As I went with them, the memory of my earlier expectations came back to me. I had imagined a grave, serious, highly intellectual future. The contrast struck me as almost absurd. The building had an enormous entrance and was colossal in scale. I was mostly aware of the growing crowd around me and of the dark opening ahead. Beyond their heads, I caught glimpses of the world around us. It looked like a vast garden that had been left to grow freely. There were bushes and flowers everywhere, but no weeds. I noticed tall spikes of strange white blossoms, each nearly a foot across. They stood scattered among the shrubs as if wild. I did not study them closely then. The time machine was left behind on the lawn among the rhododendrons. The archway was richly carved, though much of the detail was worn and broken. I thought I saw traces of very ancient decorative styles. More of the people met us at the entrance. We went in together. I must have looked ridiculous among them, dressed in my heavy clothes, covered in flowers, surrounded by bright robes and pale limbs, all moving in a soft whirl of laughter. The entrance opened into a vast hall draped in brown. The ceiling was lost in shadow. The windows were partly filled with colored glass and partly open, letting in gentle light. The floor was made of large blocks of a very hard white metal. The surface was deeply worn, grooved by countless feet over long ages. Across the hall stood many stone tables, raised slightly from the floor. On them were piles of fruit. Some looked like exaggerated versions of raspberries or oranges. Most were unfamiliar. Cushions lay scattered between the tables. My guide sat down and motioned for me to do the same. Without ceremony, they began to eat with their hands, tossing scraps into round openings along the table sides. I followed their example. I was hungry and thirsty. As I ate, I looked around. What struck me most was the state of decay. The stained glass was broken in many places. Dust lay thick on the curtains. One corner of a stone table near me was cracked, yet the overall impression was still rich and striking. There were perhaps 200 people in the hall. Many sat as close to me as they could, watching with quiet attention while they ate. All wore the same soft, strong fabric. Fruit was their only food. These people lived entirely on it. Later, I would learn that animals we depend on had long since vanished. For now, I simply ate what I was given. One fruit in particular, enclosed in a three-sided husk, became a favorite. When my hunger eased, I decided to try to learn their language. I held up a piece of fruit and made questioning sounds. At first, they stared or laughed. Eventually, a fair-haired one repeated a word. They talked among themselves at length. My attempts to copy their sounds caused a great deal of laughter. Still, I persisted. Gradually, I learned the names of objects, then simple pronouns, even a verb or two. But progress was slow. They tired quickly and drifted away. I learned to accept their lessons in short bursts. I had never met people so easily fatigued. One thing became clear to me very quickly. These little people had almost no staying power when it came to attention. They would come toward me with excited cries, clustering around as if I were a new toy. Then, just as suddenly, they would lose interest and wander away, drawn by something else. When the meal ended and my first attempts at conversation faded, I noticed that nearly everyone who had gathered around me at the start was gone. It surprised me how quickly I stopped noticing them myself. As soon as my hunger was satisfied, I passed back through the great doorway and out into the open air. The sunlight was warm, and the world lay quiet and untroubled. As I walked, I kept meeting others of their kind. They would follow me for a short distance, laughing and talking among themselves, then leave me alone again. The calm of evening settled over the land as I emerged fully from the building. The light of the setting sun spread across everything, soft and golden. At first, the scene confused me. Nothing matched the world I had known. Even the flowers seemed unfamiliar. The large structure I had left stood on the slope of a wide river valley. The river itself lay some distance away. I realized that the Thames must have shifted from its old course, perhaps by as much as a mile. I decided to climb to higher ground. From there, I hoped to gain a better view of the Earth as it existed in the year 800 and 2701. That, I should explain, was the date recorded by the small dials on the time machine. As I walked uphill, I watched carefully for anything that might explain the strange mix of beauty and decay I saw everywhere. The splendor was undeniable. But it was splendor in ruins. Not far up the slope, I came upon the remains of a vast structure. Huge blocks of granite lay bound together by masses of aluminum. The place formed a tangled maze of broken walls and collapsed heaps. Growing among the ruins were thick clusters of tall plants shaped like pagodas, their leaves tinted brown. They looked something like nettles, though they did not sting. It was clearly the remains of some immense building. What purpose it had once served, I could not guess. I did not linger. At the time, I could not know that I would return to this place later, or that it would be tied to discoveries far stranger than anything I had yet seen. From a terrace partway up the hill, I stopped to look around. That was when I noticed something odd. There were no small houses. Here and there, palace-like buildings rose among the greenery. But the cottages and private homes so common in the English landscape were nowhere to be seen. It seemed that individual houses, and perhaps even households, no longer existed. Communism, I said aloud to myself. Almost at once, another thought followed. I looked at the few small figures who had been trailing behind me. Suddenly, I saw something I should have noticed earlier. They were all dressed alike. Their faces were smooth and hairless. Their bodies had the same soft, rounded shape. Men and women were indistinguishable. The children, too, looked like smaller versions of the adults. Their bodies seemed developed far beyond what I would expect at such an age. Later, I found this impression confirmed. Given the ease and safety of their lives, this lack of difference between the sexes seemed logical enough. Strength and physical division of roles are necessities in harsh conditions. Where life is secure and danger rare, those distinctions lose their purpose. Where population is steady and survival assured, large families become unnecessary. Where violence is unknown and children are safe, there is little need for the strong structure of the family. I reminded myself that this was only my interpretation at the time. Later, I would learn how incomplete it was. As I continued upward, my thoughts were interrupted by a small, elegant structure that resembled a well beneath a dome. For a moment, I wondered at the idea of wells still existing, then returned to my reflections. There were no large buildings near the crest of the hill. As I walked, the little people gradually fell behind. My strength, which seemed remarkable compared to theirs, carried me onward. Before long, I was alone for the first time. With a sense of freedom and curiosity, I pressed on. At the top, I found a seat made of a yellow metal I did not recognize. It was corroded in places with a pinkish rust and partly covered with soft moss. The armrests were shaped like the heads of griffins. I sat down and looked out over the land. The view was gentle and beautiful. The sun had already dipped below the horizon. The west burned with gold, crossed by bands of purple and red. Below lay the valley of the Thames. The river ran through it like a strip of polished steel. Across the landscape stood the great buildings I had already seen, scattered among rich greenery. Some were clearly in ruins. Others still seemed in use. Here and there, white or silvery statues rose from the earth. Tall cupolas and slender obelisks broke the horizon. There were no fences, no fields, no signs of ownership, no agriculture. The world had become a garden. As I watched, I began to form an explanation for what I had seen. It took shape slowly that evening. Later, I would understand that it was only part of the truth. It seemed to me that humanity had reached a point of decline. The glowing sunset made me think of the fading of mankind itself. For the first time, I began to consider a possible outcome of the social progress we pursue in our own age. The idea was unsettling, but not illogical. Strength arises from need. Where life is safe, weakness survives just as well as strength. Civilization had worked steadily to make life easier and more secure. Victory after victory had been won over nature. What were once dreams had become deliberate projects, carried through with success. And here was the result. As I sat there watching the light fade, my thoughts continued along the same line. Sanitation and agriculture, as we practice them now, are still crude beginnings. Our science has only touched a small part of the vast field of disease. Yet even so, it presses forward steadily. We clear weeds here and there. We cultivate a handful of useful plants and leave the rest to compete as they can. We improve a few favored animals and fruits by slow selection, guided by imperfect knowledge and uncertain ideals. All of this, I thought, must have been carried much further in the long span of time I had crossed. Here, the air was free of insects. The earth showed no sign of weeds or fungus. Everywhere there were fruits and flowers, sweet and abundant. Butterflies drifted through the warm air. The goal of preventive medicine appeared to have been achieved. Disease had been removed. During all my time there, I saw no trace of sickness. Even decay itself, I would later learn, had been altered by these conditions. Social victories seemed just as complete. People lived in splendid shelters. They were well clothed, and I saw no one at work. There was no sign of struggle, no conflict between individuals or classes, no economic effort. Shops, trade, advertising, all the busy machinery of our own world were gone. On that peaceful evening, it was natural that I should see this as a kind of social paradise. The problem of overpopulation, I supposed, had been solved. Population had stopped growing, but such a change must bring its own consequences. What is the source of human intelligence and energy, if not difficulty and freedom? Conditions that reward strength, alertness, cooperation, and self-control. The family itself and the fierce emotions tied to it exist because children are fragile and danger is constant. Where were those dangers now? If hardship disappears, the traits shaped by hardship lose their purpose. Physical courage and the urge to fight, which once ensured survival, become useless or even harmful. In a world of perfect balance and safety, both physical and mental power would have little place. For countless generations, I imagined, there had been no war, no wild animals, no serious disease, no need for labor. In such a world, what we would call the weak would survive just as easily as the strong. Perhaps even more easily. The strong would feel restless, driven by energy with nowhere to go. The beauty of the buildings I had seen might have been the last expression of that unused energy. Art, refinement, pleasure, the final flowering before stillness. That is often the fate of energy in security. It turns toward beauty and desire. Then comes weariness, then decline. Even that artistic impulse seemed nearly gone in the time I saw. Decorating themselves with flowers, singing, dancing in the sunlight. That appeared to be all that remained. And even that, I thought, would one day fade into quiet contentment. We are sharpened by pain and necessity. Standing there, it seemed to me that this sharpening stone had finally been broken. As darkness gathered, I felt confident in this explanation. It appeared simple, complete. It accounted for the gentle people, their frailty, the ruined buildings, the absence of struggle. Perhaps the controls they had placed on the population had worked too well. Their numbers may have declined. That would explain the abandoned structures scattered across the land. It was a clear theory, convincing, neatly arranged, and like most such theories, it was wrong. But at that moment, as the last light drained from the sky, I believed I had understood the world before me. I thought I had grasped the meaning of these graceful, idle people. I thought I had solved the problem of their existence. I could not have been more mistaken.